Forward. Lewis and Hitler, Parallel Lives, by John Chapman. Adolf Hitler, to quote Gustav Eymard, is the idea whose time has come and whose hour has struck. If one were to paraphrase a more famous Frenchman, that of Voltaire, one might say if Adolf Hitler did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. So ubiquitous and fascinating Adolf Hitler has been that even when reduced to a one-dimensional caricature that makes the devil look sheepish, science fiction writers of time travel stories find it necessary to spare him in their own works, as Hitler is the Atlas carrying the postmodern world, its technological development, and its morality on his shoulders. Students within Community College Philosophy 101 classes might brag about having the bravery of killing baby Hitler, but there's no doubt that they would blink at the prospect of losing the one man that defines their entire existence. Time magazine has earned eternal enmity for once naming Adolf Hitler their Man of the Year. Their only error was in not naming him the Man of the Century. The winner was Albert Einstein, with runners-up being Gandhi and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Under their own rules for Man of the Year, it was meant to signify who was the most consequential person in that year, independent of morality. They rarely ever get it right, but they got it right there, even if they couched it in descriptions later discarded by the magazine's detractors that described Hitler as the, quote, greatest threatening force that the democratic, freedom-loving world faces today, unquote. There is no argument to be had. Hitler was the most consequential person of the 20th century, and if the zeitgeist is anything to go by, then he should already be on the 21st century shortlist, despite being dead for 75 years. Hitler is not a man whom invites indifference. The only way to have no opinion on him is to have no opinions at all. For those who shape society and sentiment, however, moral disgust suffices in the place of thought. What cannot be denied, not by traumatized Jews, not by agitated liberals, and not even by milquetoast critics of the right, is that the mystique of Hitler is something both ethereal and extraordinary. Savitri Devi, the forerunner of the spiritual view of Hitler that has been codified as esoteric Hitlerism, wrote of Hitler as the man against time in The Lightning and the Sun. Hitler as avatar of the Hindu god Vishnu is something that will not truck with anyone other than the overliterate handful who get lost somewhere between the weeds of irony and the forests of sincerity, but it is impossible not to be drawn into this concept of Hitler as the man against time. According to Devi's work, men in time are the lightning, the destructive energies of civilizational conflict that keep the world in cyclical decay. Men above time are the sun, the creative and life-affirming qualities that elevate civilization above decay and create a renewal that can usher in the golden ages. The man against time, however, are the lightning and the sun, combining both of these qualities in order to create a new order and golden age of the sun through the destructive and leveling qualities of the lightning. To give birth to life, you must also sweep away the dead, Devi writes in The Lightning and the Sun. And in an epoch, such as that in which we are now living, when, all over the world, every possible attempt is made to present him not merely as a warmonger, but as a war criminal, number one, it is not superfluous to stress the fact that Adolf Hitler was, not only at the dawn of his awakening, a man against time, but all his life a bitter enemy of war, as such. The fact that he was by nature gifted with deep sensitiveness and full of sympathy for others, that his program was essentially a constructive one, his struggle for the struggle of an exalted positive aim, his aim, the regeneration of the higher mankind, only of the section of mankind worth saving, and, ultimately, through the survival of the regenerated higher mankind, the restoration of the long-destroyed harmony between the cosmic order and the socio-political conditions on Earth, that is to say, the restoration of the Golden Age conditions, the opening not merely of a new era for Germany, but of a new time cycle for the whole world. Many will quibble with Devi's effusive views of Hitler. Many will balk at this oracular perspective. None can deny, however, that Hitler has a particular quality to him that defies description, and so anyone willing to broach this forbidden subject soon discovers that Hitler becomes not just a mirror to the person who approaches his subject, but a magnifier of everything that pours out of them. That same effusive view of Hitler as a bitter enemy of war or as a man of peace would get another writer in trouble, Wyndham Lewis, in his 1931 treatise, Hitler. This is the quality that Wyndham Lewis wished to capture in his analysis of Hitler. He knew that there was something there, but he also knew how unhappy his English audience would be at his attempt to uncover the mystery of the Hitlerites without screaming demons at every explanation of their growing movement. The English language is replete with thought-terminating clichés like it is what it is, signifying that things may just happen for no reason and have no explanation. But of course, an entire country could fall under the hypnotic spell of a man with a magical mustache who could lie bald-faced to them, big lie, and just make them do things that are simply against their better nature. It just happens. Lewis understood the sentiment was bunk and wanted to understand what was really going on, no matter how offended his audience would be at the National Socialist views on everything, but especially economics and Jews. Wyndham Lewis is not a figure you'll hear much about, except from people who really like Wyndham Lewis. He was both a painter and a writer, though he is probably more known these days for his writings than his paintings. Lewis was, in many ways, the embodiment of the pan-Anglo experience of the expansive and fungible global empire. Born to an English mother and an American father off the coast of Canada in 1882, in some respects his life superficially paralleled that of his subject Adolf Hitler and made him an effective counterpart. Both men had difficult family lives with disappointed fathers. Hitler's beat him, while Lewis is wrote to his estranged wife, am greatly disappointed with the boy and have unpleasant misgivings about his future. Both men lived in the gray zones of what their nations were, with Lewis's pan-Anglo identity and Hitler's experience of being an Austrian with a German-Bavarian dialect putting him in a world without inner Teutonic borders. Both men served heroically in the Great War, and both men were artists constantly on the outs of society. Both men were inevitably drawn to fascism with a small f, but sought to find it in their own way. Lewis, however, is rarely connected with Adolf Hitler except in his explicit works where he wrote about him, a shame that would dog him for the rest of his life and would be frequently ignored by his admirers who want to admire him on his own terms. But writing Hitler would leave its own undeniable mark, his own scarlet A, as it were. Prior to writing Hitler, much of Lewis's life followed that early fascist track. The explosive energy that informed many of the modernist and avant-garde movements that informed early fascism, as those young men were not reactionaries but a new type of man dissatisfied with liberal bourgeois society, was found within Wyndham Lewis as well. He started his own aesthetic movement called Vorticism, an Anglo alternative to the expressionist, cubist, and futurist movements that had lit an artistic flame in continental Europe and were often hand-in-hand with radical politics. Many of the first fascists in Italy had risen up out of futurism. Perhaps because England had more to look back on and less to look forward to watching their sun just beginning to set, Lewis's work never quite made the same cultural but especially political impact as the Futurists. Starting first as a painter, he would begin his writing career with the modernist novel Tar, a typical novel about the frustrations of artistic young men angry at phonies and posers with money who fashioned themselves as bohemians. More parallels between the lives of Hitler and Lewis can be found in this novel as the two main characters are the Englishman Tar, a ready stand-in for Wyndham Lewis, and the German Otto Kreisler, an angry failed artist brimming with explosive creative energy, and whose desire to protect his honor leads him to killing a Pole in a duel and then committing suicide before it can be properly brought to justice. Through the 1920s, Lewis would throw himself into the role of the constant satirist of the people and world he knew and positioned himself as their perpetual enemy, declaring himself as such by launching a magazine entitled The Enemy. There was philosophy in his writings and critiques, however, and he sought to find a more perfect Western world in the works such as The Art of Being Ruled and Time in Western Man. At the close of the decade, he would write a brutal satire of the London literary world entitled The Apes of God, which would have been enough to keep him on the outs of respectable cultural elites were it not for what he would publish next. While Lewis brawled with the intelligentsia in the Anglo world in the 1920s, Hitler and the National Socialist German Workers' Party brawled in the streets and at the polls of Germany's deeply divided Weimar Republic. Hitler and the NSDAP did not suddenly sneak up on the world. There were enough outside observers that were aware and raised various levels of alarm at their presence as the National Socialist fortunes waxed and waned. While the 1933 elections were the bolt from the brown that caused the whole world to rub their sleepy eyes and take notice of what was going on, Wyndham Lewis had just happened to be in Germany during the National Socialists' meteoric 1930 rise. The May 1928 election had given them 2.6% of the vote, while the September 1930 election netted them 18.3%, and the second largest number of seats in the Reichstag. The Nazis had arrived under the Linden trees, and Lewis was there in the midst of Babylon, Berlin. He had actually only arrived in Germany in November of 1930, 2 months after the earth-shattering election. His initial reason for the arrival had been to seek a German publisher for The Apes of God, a curious mission given the limited appeal that a satire on London literary figures would have certainly had on a German public in the midst of their own deep culture war. While on this trip, he got to experience firsthand this National Socialist movement that was sending shivers down the spine of European leaders. He was certainly fascinated, how could he not be, and he hatched what he thought would be a lucrative journalistic scheme, an English-language profile and explanation of this movement and its enigmatic leader Adolf Hitler. He dashed off 40,000 words on the subject, titled it Hitler, and sent it for publishing within months of his stay in Germany. Lewis received only a £100 advance for this timely work, £6,800 today or $8,800. For someone as well known and established as Wyndham Lewis, this was the equivalent of a first-time and unknown author getting their first advance. This was as much as the publisher would offer even after Lewis insisted on its worth and topicality, pennies on the dollar. The work permanently damaged Lewis's work, but it did not bury him. Ironically, what saved him was likely being so early with it, allowing him to claim being duped or foolish when it came time for international liberalism to wipe the slate clean. It was still a rather large brick that Lewis added to his own mausoleum, even if antagonizing the culturally powerful and being associated with men like Ezra Pound, while preferring the black principle, fascists, over the red one, Bolsheviks, built that foundation. While Hitler by Wyndham Lewis is as forgotten as the man Hitler himself is unforgotten, it has the honor of being the first book to study the phenomenon of Hitler and the National Socialists. Its value as a literary artifact of a time is unmistakable. First impressions are always the most fascinating, and you won't find a work as nuanced, right and wrong, and complex as this work. Time capsules are so few and far between, and are especially ignored by historians who require a unified picture of the past. Thus, Lewis's work occupies a curious and similar space as Carrie Thornley's The Idle Warriors, the only work to have profiled Lee Harvey Oswald before the Kennedy assassination. There is some amusement in the contemporary reaction to the work. The liberal and left-wing reaction is boring and predictable, with the same kind of tut-tutting, screeching, and kvetching, while the right-wing reaction is much more interesting. Some Sort of Genius, by Paul O'Keefe, asserts that the honorary secretary of the Kensington Fascist Group took issue with Lewis's assertion that Germany was a far greater nation than Italy, for example. Some Sort of Genius sheds further light on why this work is largely unknown to this day, as it was criticized for being biased, sloppily written, badly researched, and inaccurate. But nowhere was it condemned as morally tainted. Supporting fascism or National Socialism did not carry with it the stigma in 1931 that it would carry 2 years later. Wyndham Lewis's account of Hitler and the events and environments that precipitated his rise may appear like gazing into a funhouse mirror into the past, or a regular mirror after being born and raised in a funhouse. Germany of the early 1930s is both alien to our popular imagination, but all too familiar in the ways that are forbidden to know. Lewis reflected on that German experience firsthand, bringing the public a man-at-the-scene account of the decadent Weimar experience that has been fodder for the rule stick on how far the United States and European nations have come. His account of the El Dorado nightclub is especially vibrant and diverse. El Dorado had been the gold standard for anything goes. It was the pioneer of drug-soaked unisex androgyny, where if one inquired to whatever the dancer was, according to Voluptuous Panic by Mel Gordon, the reply was, "I am whatever sex you wish me to be, madame." Marlene Dietrich found a home there before being scooped up into American film, while homosexual and possible dabbler in amateur spycraft, Christopher Isherwood, was a frequent customer. His experience would inspire Cabaret. Wyndham Lewis writes of El Dorado's Berlin as the pervert's paradise, and vividly of the dancers with the painted red rosette nipples beneath the male token of chin stubble. El Dorado, however, is just one establishment out of the 160, according to Lewis. Voluptuous Panic provides lurid details of the scene that has become legendary to the discourse surrounding the rise of Hitler and the National Socialists. Gordon quotes from the Italian journalist and politician Luigi Barzini in his 1983 memoir, The Europeans, on just what sort of delights were available to those willing to seek them within Babylon, Berlin. "I saw pimps offering anything to anyone, little boys, little girls, robust young men, libidinous women, animals. The story went around that a male goose, of which one cut the neck at the ecstatic moment, would give you the most delicious, economical, and time-saving frisson of all, as it allowed you to enjoy sodomy, bestiality, homosexuality, necrophilia, and sadism all at one stroke. Gastronomy, too, as one could eat the goose afterwards." While many focus on the apocryphal goose story, there was no doubt much to gander at in this night scene to the point that the name Weimar itself has become a synonym for the lowest reaches of hedonism. It is no wonder, then, that, according to Lewis in Hitler, that, quote, "Sooner or later, the National Socialist would desire to be at the head or in the midst of his Sturmabteilung, to roll this nigger dance luxury spot up like a verminous carpet and to drop it into the spree." This was the moment that Lewis wished to capture. Everyone seemed to know that something historical and revolutionary was happening, that the smell of it was in the air for everyone to breathe. And no matter how much Lewis wanted to be the neutral observer of this rising National Socialist revolution, he could not help but write in wonder of it the same way that would-be nationalists and dissidents within the dominating liberal hegemony would look back on it for inspiration. Dominique Venner, reflecting on the National Socialist Revolution in For a Positive Critique, saw it as nothing the next wave of nationalists could emulate. It wasn't a recipe you could just replicate. Add one Weimar Republic, two dashes of degenerate culture, mixed with street violence, bank and anger until ready. The times changed. The tactics were now wrong. What had greatly frightened many who saw the rise of National Socialists were the revolutionary progressive nature. And Lewis notes this in Hitler. These were not the staid conservatives and reactionaries that could be battered around like the strawmen they volunteered themselves to be, but a rejuvenating force that sought to capture the spirit of the times and master it to their own will, by hook or by crook. Lewis saw in Hitler, at the time, the oneness that was so lacking in nationalist reactionaries. He compares Hitler to the French integralist Charles Maurras, who may have been an aristocrat of the soul, but lacked the everyman touch that Hitler seemed to embody. Hitler's critics from the right are quick to pounce on these vulgar energies, though may have missed the irony that Hitler could quite easily have been called the moderate Nazi. There are passages within Hitler that will bring to mind the idea that all of this happened before and will happen again. Lewis notes the hand-wringing about the energy and minds of the youth being captured by the National Socialists, decades before the word brainwashed would ever enter the lexicon. He notes the hypocrisy that if these young men were Marxists, they would be praised, but as National Socialists, they are suddenly exploited and tricked. The utopian always believes himself to be in the last stage, from the liberals, to the Marxists, to the neoconservatives, and to the technological fascists. They may or may not believe that history is written by the victors, but they certainly believe that history ends with them. The cycle of history and civilization has been mastered and conquered for all time. They are then promptly buried into nice little dirt plots, and the eternal struggle resumes without their consent or permission. A good portion of the book is taken up by Lewis explaining the concept of Blutsgefühl, or blood feeling. He preemptively dismisses the Anglo-American ability to truly understand what this means. Lewis certainly seems to be aware that his contemporary, D.H. Lawrence, who was married to a German woman, had some understanding of this, however. Lawrence, who died in 1930, had coined the term blood consciousness to describe his own sense of essence. Where Lawrence's definition only kept an implication of race, however, the German word as Lewis describes it excludes it. Curiously, this word does not appear much outside of a Wyndham Lewis context. There is no etymology to Lawrence's coining of his own English version, but that he was married to Frieda, born Emma Maria Frieda Johanna Freien von Richthofen, until his dying days, raises eyebrows at this coincidence. There is value in contrasting these two feelings. Lewis describes Blutsgefühl as the foundation of National Socialism and as a closer and closer drawing together of the people of one race and culture by means of bodily attraction, a true bodily solidarity. Lawrence, in his description of a blood consciousness, was reacting to the popularity of Freudian psychoanalysis in his day and offered an alternative understanding in Fantasia of the Unconscious. Sex is our deepest form of consciousness. It is utterly non-ideal, non-mental. It is pure blood consciousness. It is the basic consciousness of the blood, the nearest thing in us to pure material consciousness. It is the consciousness of the night, when the soul is almost asleep. The blood consciousness is the first and last knowledge of the living soul, the depths. It is the soul acting in part only, speaking with its first hoarse half-voice. For Lawrence, there was a becoming of man in the blood consciousness. For Lewis, he understood Blutsgefühl as the becoming of race and feeling. Both currents were in one form or another the emergence of essence, becoming who you are, as the cliché goes. For Wyndham Lewis, however, there must be a rejection of this exotic sense, something he saw D.H. Lawrence and other writers indulging in. Per Lewis, what, after all, is the exoticist, but the white conqueror turned literary and sentimental? Lewis is a bit harsh on Lawrence in his explanation of the exotic sense, though sensing rightly that Lawrence had too much sympathy for the renegades against Western civilization, even if he exhorted his readers that they could not go to the savages. There was something within England, as well as France, that Lewis notes tended towards fascination, sympathy, and engaging with the exotic. Orientalism was strongest in both England and France, coupled in England's case with a feeling of Zionism, and not coincidentally, frequent pederasty. But there was also some affection for the sub-Saharan African, both in culture, especially in its Americanized form, and as a tool in the racial subjugation of European enemies. Sims, in Hitler, A Global Biography, argues that Hitler was obsessed more with the Anglo-nations of Britain and the United States, and its international and colonizing financial capitalism than he was with Bolshevik Russia. Detractors to this thesis point to the respect that Hitler had for the British, but this is not necessarily a contradiction. One can have a terrible awe for the power of a rival, and certainly Hitler saw the endgame of history as a great civil war between the emergent Aryan superpowers. Sims backs up his thesis with the shock and awe felt by the Germans at the way the supreme colonial powers had either absorbed German emigrants into their own ranks, turning Volkish boys against the fatherland, or the way they deployed a dark rainbow horde from the colonies to sweep against the central powers within European land. France in particular was known for its vindictiveness with which it deployed Senegalese soldiers to kill and then to police the Rhineland as a form of biopower and racial warfare. Though historians downplay the number of mixed-raced Rhineland bastards that were born from the African soldiers stationed in the Rhineland, the effect of it was enough that it became one of the most prominent rallying tools for the National Socialists. The big lie of the era is that modern men thought and behaved like postmodern men, that segregationists who stormed the beaches of Normandy did so because they were pro-Antifa. The big lie of this era is that race belief was even then the realm of cranks, or that it was so fully discredited by argument that race thought was never thought of again. This despite the rising tide of color against white world supremacy by Northrop Stoddard being important enough to be referenced in The Great Gatsby and H.G. Wells painting a world where European men are policed and beaten by black policemen in their own cities in the dystopian novel The Sleeper Awakes. In his 1936 novel Absalom, Absalom, William Faulkner's Canadian character Shreve turns into a terrible seer about the mixed-race descendants of terrible white men swarming the earth. I think that in time, the Jim Bonds are going to conquer the Western Hemisphere. Of course, it won't quite be in our time, and of course, as they spread out towards the poles, they will bleach out again, like the rabbits and the birds do, so they won't show up so sharp against the snow. But it will still be Jim Bond. And so, in a few thousand years, I who regard you will also have sprung up from the loins of African kings. With the chapter The Fox and the Goose, Lewis reveals much more of his intentions and his heart. A thoughtful veteran of the Great War, he knew its innumerable questions went unresolved, and like Enoch Powell, he saw a deluge of blood in the river that was rising. He constantly cautions, hedging his bets, knowing it will never be safe for him to say that Hitler has some good answers to some good questions, and so he all but endorses the Hitlerist position as he praises Hitler's understanding of the struggle ahead. For Lewis, this is the struggle against extinction. Perhaps as an Englishman, he knew there would be no true resistance from the Empire to its conquered subjects returning home to roost. It was fitting that he would use this in animal terms, as the Aryans are endangered and have been since Lewis wrote his book. It is undeniable when people like Tiny Tim Wise make statements such as, "In the pantheon of American history, conservative old white people have pretty much always been the bad guys, the keepers of hegemonic and reactionary flame, the folks unwilling to share the category of American with others on equal terms. Fine, keep it up. It doesn't matter, because you're on the endangered list, and unlike, say, the bald eagle or some exotic species of muskrat, you are not worth saving." These are not only familiar feelings to be found within Wyndham Lewis's Hitler. The reader will find that, just as they are transported back to the 1930s in Lewis's writing, just how little has actually changed in this discourse. The same discourses over what is white and Aryan, and what about the high IQ of Ashkenazi Jews like Albert Einstein, that the idea of nation is a little absurd because it was a recent construction, and these nations are more provincial and tribal than you assert, and does that not shake your confidence in your beliefs, are all things to be found in these writings. The non-liberal, of course, must answer 10,000 volleys to their beliefs, while the project of liberal supremacy, which often withers at the merest objections made by men like Carl Schmitt, is protected from a single one. That is the struggle, though, is it not? Hegemony is its own morality, especially in the hegemon that fancies itself the most supreme for being kinder, gentler, and more inclusive. Despite these nuances, this is a book that is unlikely to change many minds or opinions on Hitler. It is great value as a curiosity of its time, though not for the reasons you would expect. There are no revolutionary insights into Hitler or the Hitler movement. What the reader may find themselves asking over and over again is, why did Lewis write this when he had no expectation of changing English minds? The work is suffused with a pessimistic tone towards the English people in their ability to understand who the National Socialists were and why they were as they were. Chapters are spent explaining just why the English will not be able to understand. The 1930s were a turbulent decade for Lewis, especially politically. He ran into the position many of those who were anti-communist found themselves in, that you might have to take a stand against communism alongside people your enemies really hate. In Count Your Dead, Lewis opined on the Spanish Civil War and found himself predictably in the minority of English intelligentsia when he called Franco, quote, "no more a fascist than you are, but a Catholic soldier who didn't like seeing priests and nuns killed, didn't want to see all of his friends murdered for no better reason that they all went to mass and the more expensive cafes and were usually able to scrape enough money together to have a haircut and a shave." Lewis found himself stuck in a position all too familiar to the right-wingers of the Anglosphere. What to do when choices are a left-wing, who will provide one terrible choice, and conservatives who will offer nothing at all. 6 years earlier in Hitler, these same sentiments were there when Lewis wrote, "So even if Hitlerism and its pure Germanism might retain too much personality of a second-rate order, nevertheless Hitlerism seems preferable to communism, which would have none at all if it had its way." This initial book by Lewis comes from the tradition of Anglo-empiricism along the veins of Lothrop Stoddard, A.J.P. Taylor, and Henry Ashby Turner. Lewis was the quintessential progressive artist, and his draw to Hitlerism is as much novelty-seeking as it was sympathy for the devil, the ultimate underdog. In 1930, the opposition to National Socialists had reached a fever pitch. The Social Democrats were firmly in control of Prussia, and its police force used every opportunity to harass and prosecute the National Socialists in a manner that would be familiar to political dissidents today. Lewis was never forgiven for cataloging this in Hitler, and the portrayal has been thrown into the piles of bias and historical misrepresentation, even as he lived and saw the history himself. The murder of Horst Wessel by a communist street pimp led to Wessel's door by his communist landlord put an exclamation mark on the violence of that era. Violence which would only intensify when the KDP, the Communist Party of Germany, began an open campaign of assassination against pro-NSDAP bar owners in the autumn of the next year. Despite living through this history, Lewis was to later rue his romanticization of the NSDAP's early struggles. What would cause a man who once wrote in Hitler, quote, "When two nations fall out, the armament king and chemical king rake in the shekels. When two men fall out, the lawyer coins the money. When two classes fall out, it is the same thing. Power or wealth passes from both to some third class," to disavow Adolf Hitler and take up the cause of the poor downtrodden Jew? It was not the fact that the NSDAP was no longer novel or the underdog, or they failed to uphold campaign promises. Rather, Lewis changed his tone because the persecution he observed in Germany was finally brought to bear on him. He ran and he ran hard. He ran from his own work as he was no William Joyce, a man he had also briefly associated with, but who was willing to throw all in with the Germans, who, at his trumped-up expectations, stated, "I am proud to die for my ideas, and I am sorry for the sons of Britain who have died without knowing why." He was known to have visited the leader of the British Union of Fascists, Oswald Mosley, who reflected on him in his autobiography as a man who, quote, "used to come up to see him in the most conspiratorial fashion, at dead of night with his collar upturned." Wherever and whenever Lewis was asked about the Hitler book after the rise of the National Socialists, he was happy to let it be pulped. And pulp it accordingly became, he wrote. Even before the situation with his connections to Ezra Pound and whispers of treason made him try to expunge all memories of that turbulent period, he attempted to rectify his position and weather the coming storm. He worked hard to absolve himself by 1939, as the next European war was increasingly inevitable, by publishing in that same year two works meant to give him the plausible deniability from his past that he desperately sought. The first was The Complete Repudiation of Hitler, entitled The Hitler Cult, and the second was a satire on anti-Semitism, entitled Jews, Are They Human? Even within the Hitler cult, Lewis finds it necessary to invent Hitler. He recites his litany of experiences with the National Socialists in order to show that his contact with them was quite limited. The parallel prophetic powers of Lewis continue within this work. Just as he foresaw the beginning of Hitler in Tar, he saw his incoming end 6 years later in the Hitler cult. National Socialism will die a violent death. Everything points to that solution. I give it a few years at the outside. It may die in battle. It may blow its brains out. It may burst. It may merge insensibly into something else. But it will no longer be there in, let us say, 6 years' time. I should be sorry to assert that all those who execrate it are saints, or even honest men. But from whatever angle you observe it, it is not an attractive phenomenon. Hardly an intelligent man will be found who will regret it. Meanwhile, in The Jews, Are They Human?, Lewis throws himself at the feet of philo-Semitism, an easy task for an Englishman. Even within Hitler, Lewis was walking the edges of it, reminding his English audience just how much they had civilized the Jewish people and entered into a harmonious matrimony with them. He continues in this track in The Jews, Are They Human?, writing obsequious passages to the Jews that are no doubt meant to chase off the audience that he feared he had cultivated. Lewis was a satirical writer who bit who he could until he could draw the piss out of them, but The Jews, Are They Human? Is so craven in its self-deprecatory humor that one can't help but think of a beaten dog scuttering around its master. Take, for example, this passage in the relationship between Jews and the English. Then, even if they did decide to remain with us, the Jews are one of the most industrious races in the world, and we are one of the least industrious. They will set a high standard of hard work, at least, which it will be necessary for the rest of us to live up to. That will be most salutary. It is worth paying people to come here to teach us how to work. We could not have better instructors. Through the 1940s, Lewis tried to get himself back into the good graces of liberal society by praising men like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the melting pot and racial incoherency of the United States. Memories were longer than Lewis wished to give people credit for, and his brief star never shone brightly again. By the early 1950s, Lewis was blind and beginning his slow shuffle into his 1957 grave. Those memories of his flirtation with fascism lasted long enough that after he had made enemies of all the earth, more than enough of them were quite willing to let him be forgotten, and for much of literary history he was. The man that W.H. Auden once called that lonely old volcano of the right sputtered off into obscurity and became less of a volcano and more of a fire anthill. Nearly 90 years since Hitler was first published, one comes away thinking that Lewis had given up before the fighting even started. The English are as they are, and they're never going to change. There'll always be an England, as that famous song went. But will there be? Vera Lynn has only passed away in this Anno Domini of 2020. One wonders what she thought looking around living through the years since Lewis published Hitler and the changes England underwent until the day she died. While Wyndham Lewis retains a small cadre of devoted followers, largely Anglophiles, students of modernism and fans of the era, it is certain that interest in him will rise in conjunction with interest in his work on Adolf Hitler. The men lived parallel lives, and Lewis, being the elder brother, thought he could keep a step ahead of the little brother in his tide. Hitler was pulped, its ideas supposedly supplanted in subsequent works, and yet here it is, almost a century later. Literary immortality, whether Lewis liked it or not. Hitler is not going anywhere. This is his world, and we're all just living in it, whether his followers win or fail. As the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard scribbled down in his journals, the tyrant dies and his rule is over. The martyr dies and his rule begins. In Hitler's case, it might be said to be both.